Okay, thank you very much. Okay, well, it's really a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the kind invitation to come visit Toronto. I'm having a lot of fun today. So I want to tell you about a story which has developed over the past 5 years or so. And what we have discovered is a new class of electronic materials. It's really a new electronic phase of matter. And the way we think about it is by thinking about the topology of energy bands. And so that's what I want to describe to you today. So I'll give you some introduction and to sort of tell you what I mean by topological band theory, and then describe these new materials, which can exist in as two-dimensional systems and also as three-dimensional crystals. And so there are a number of things one might think about doing with these materials once we have them. And so what I'm going to describe to you is the most ambitious idea of them all, which has not been accomplished yet, but if it could, then it may lead the way towards designing a topological quantum computer. So I'll try to explain to you how that works. So this work started off as a collaboration with my colleague Jean Malie from the University of Pennsylvania, and so we sort of did the initial work, and then since then I was joined by my students, Liang Fu and Jeffrey Teo, and in particular, Liang, who just finished last summer, has really played a central role in a lot of this work. So let me sort of start with the beginning, with the most basic phase of matter, which is the insulating state. So the simplest way of thinking about an insulator is that you have atoms with electrons bound to them, and all the electrons are tightly bound to the atoms, and so the whole thing is completely inert, because it takes a finite amount of energy to dislodge an electron from the atoms. So there's a big energy gap. So the simplest insulator maybe would be sort of a crystal of inert atoms, which has a huge energy gap of, you know, of an atomic energy scale. You know, as you bring the atoms closer together, they can begin to interact, and one can have covalent insulators, for instance, like a semiconductor. And so one of the triumphs of quantum mechanics in the last century was the development of a language for describing the electronic properties of crystals. Okay, and this language is known as the band theory of solids. And so the ingredients of the band theory of solids is one thinks about the electronic states that electrons can have in a crystal, taking advantage of the translational symmetry that the crystal has. And so what that allows one to do is to classify the electronic states in terms of their crystal momentum. Okay, which is almost like the ordinary momentum, but the crystal momentum sort of lives in, is only defined in a finite, what's called a Brillouin zone. Okay, and so one can classify the energy as a function of momentum, and it has these various energy bands. And in an insulator, there is an energy gap which separates the occupied electronic states, which are in the valence band, from the empty electronic states, which are in the conduction band. And so it's just like the empty states of an atom are the conduction band, and this is the valence band, okay? But in an insulator, the energy gap can be much smaller. In silicon, it's about 1 electron volt. But there's a sense in which both of these are really sort of the same. They're both characterized by the absence of any low-energy electronic excitations. It takes a finite energy to do anything, to dislodge an electron from the valence band to the conduction band. Now, on the other hand, the insulating state is really, it's also like the vacuum. You know, the vacuum actually isn't as empty as you might first think. You know, if you think about Dirac's formulation of quantum mechanics, the vacuum, one can have, electrons, but one can also have positrons, which really are sort of like holes. The only difference is that the energy gap of the Dirac vacuum is much larger. It's a million electron volts, which is the energy to make a electron positron pair. Now, so the point that I want to make is that there's a sense in which all of these are similar to each other, in that I can imagine sort of, making my, just sort of smoothly making my band gap get bigger and bigger and bigger to bridge these entire things. And so the question I want to ask is, are all insulators, are all materials with a band gap the same? And the answer to that is actually no. And so I want to describe a counterexample, something which you might think would be an insulator, but in fact isn't. And this is what happens when you have electrons in two dimensions in a strong magnetic field. Okay, and this leads to something called the integer quantum Hall effect. And so in a magnetic field, what electrons like to do is they like to go around in circles. Okay, cyclotron motion of the electrons. And when you think in terms of quantum mechanics, when you have closed circular orbits, that means that the electronic states are going to be quantized. You're just like in an atom. And those quantized energy levels are called Landau levels. And so you can have a situation where you have these discrete Landau levels, and you can have some of these Landau levels are filled, and then there's an energy gap to the next Landau level. And that's what happens in the integer quantum Hall effect. Now, so you have this situation where there's an energy gap separating the occupied states from the empty states, like in an insulator. But in fact, this situation, it's not an insulator. Because if you apply an electric field, then you know what happens to cyclotron orbits when you have a crossed electric and magnetic field. The cyclotron orbits start to drift. So there's an electric current that flows perpendicular to the electric field. That's called the Hall effect. Okay? And in fact, when you do this with this integer number of filled Landau levels, what you find is that the electric current that flows perpendicular to the electric field defines a conductivity which is actually quantized in units of E squared over H, which is a fundamental a unit of conductance. Okay? And amazingly, there have been several Nobel Prizes that have been awarded for this physics. This quantization can be measured extremely accurately. And this is really, there's something very, very special going on here which makes this this thing very accurately quantized when one measures it. But the point I want to make is that it's not an insulator, okay? Even though there's a band gap, and what I want to say is that this is sort of like a band structure, okay? And so one can have a band structure with an energy gap that's not an insulator. And to drive this point even further, I want to make a digression briefly to think about another material. Which is of very exciting interest these days, which is called graphene. So graphene, we all know what graphite is. Graphite is what your pencil lead is made out of. And graphene is a single two-dimensional plane of graphite. Okay, and this is something which is in the last few years has become very exciting because people have figured out how to experimentally probe single planes of graphene. So I'm not going to talk too much about graphene, but I want to say what it is that is interesting about graphene from its electronic point of view. And the thing that's interesting is that, like in an insulator, there is a valence band and a conduction band. But what happens is the valence band and the conduction band, they just barely touch each other at points in the Brillouin zone. So the energy gap is actually zero. Okay, but it's a very special situation in that the electronic states touch each other at these points where the dispersion relation that describes the energy as a function of momentum is linear, the way it is in relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay, and in fact, if you want to describe the electronic states, one uses a equation that looks like the relativistic equation of quantum mechanics, which is called the Dirac equation. Okay, and so these electrons that have this kind of linear conical dispersion are called Dirac fermions. Okay, and so this is the thing that happens in graphene. And so one thing that I want to make, so I'm going to come back to pictures like this later in the talk, and one point that I want to make is that actually in graphene, there are two sets of these Dirac fermions, okay? And there's a deep reason why there have to be two, okay? And so you have these two. Now, the thing that I want to say, though, is that one can also make graphene into an insulator by adding a perturbation. Okay, and so this is something that Duncan Haldane did 20 years ago. So he was ahead of his time thinking about graphene. At the time, he didn't know that it was possible to actually experimentally study graphene. And Duncan's a theorist, and so he wasn't too concerned about how practical what he was thinking was doing. And so what he imagined doing was taking graphene and applying a periodic magnetic field. Okay? And so what he did was he wanted to apply a magnetic field which was periodic, had the periodicity of the lattice, so that it was positive in some places, you know, in the middles of the hexagons, and negative sort of on the edges, so that there's no net magnetic flux in the crystal. And so what that allows him to do is to, you still have this sort of lattice periodicity, you can still label your electronic states with crystal momentum. You still have a band structure. Okay? But what he showed is that the degeneracy that makes the conduction band and the valence band touch each other gets lifted, so that there is an energy gap that arises. Okay? So that means that the graphene with this magnetic field has a band structure that looks just like an insulator. Okay? You wouldn't, if you looked at the energy bands, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the band structure of graphene with this magnetic field and an insulator. And yet, what he showed is that the state that you get is not an insulating state, it's a quantum Hall state. It's like this, it's this thing that has the quantized Hall conductivity. Okay? And so this leads to a very deep question, which is, what is the difference between this and an ordinary insulator? Okay, the energy bands look just the same. Okay, so why is one an insulator and the other a quantum Hall state? And the answer to that is a question of topology. Okay, and this leads me into topological band theory. Okay, so the point is the following. So what is a band structure? A band structure is a collection of states which live in this Brillouin zone, which is again this sort of finite collection of momenta that the states can have. Okay, and the topology of a Brillouin zone is a torus. It's like the surface of a donut in two dimensions. Okay, so what the band structure is this collection of states defined at each point on the torus. So it's like a mapping from the Brillouin zone, which is a torus, into the Hilbert space, which is where the electronic states reside. And it is a fact that these kinds of mappings can be classified topologically. Okay, and so this is something that was actually known by the mathematicians for many, many years, but it was discovered by the physicists by David Thallus and his collaborators in 1982. And what they showed is that there is a topological invariant which distinguishes these different topological classifications, which is an integer, and that this integer is in fact the same integer that's in the integer quantum Hall effect. It's the integer that you measure to 1 part in 10 to the ninth. Okay? Now, so it's hard for me to explain what this formula means mathematically, but let me try to give you an analogy, which is a little bit easier to visualize. And the analogy is to think, rather than thinking about this abstract mapping from a torus into Hilbert space, which is like a complex vector space, let's just think about mappings from 2 dimensions into 3 dimensions, which defines 2-dimensional surfaces in 3 dimensions. Now, there's a beautiful theorem in mathematics, which is called the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. Okay, and what the Gauss-Bonnet theorem says is that if you have some surface that, if you integrate the Gaussian curvature over that surface, okay, so at every point there's a Gaussian curvature and you can integrate that over the surface. If you integrate the Gaussian surface, then the integral you get is quantized in some units of 2 pi, something like that. Okay, and moreover, the value that you get of that integral tells you about the topology of the surface, and in particular, it tells you what the genus of the surface, which is the number of holes that it has, is. So it, for instance, distinguishes between the surface of this, you know, orange and the surface of the bowl from the surface of the donut, which has a hole in it, and the surface of the coffee cup, which also has a hole in it. Okay? And so, so there's a sense in which these are topologically equivalent, these are topologically equivalent, but they're topologically different. So and it's this integral which distinguishes them. Okay? So this Chern invariant, which is this mathematical invariant characterizing these, is sort of the same kind of thing. The only difference is that it's describing mappings into this complex vector space. Okay? And so the result is that band structures can be classified topologically. Okay. Now, so what consequences does this topological classification have? And the most interesting consequence occurs when you have an interface between two different topological phases. So you can have a material that's in one topological phase here, another topological phase here, and put them together. Okay? One topological phase might be the vacuum. Okay, which is sort of the trivial topological phase. And so what has to happen when you have these interfaces is that there have to be conducting gapless electronic states. Okay, and this is the deep result. Okay, and so in the quantum Hall effect, this is actually this is something that you can understand from more elementary terms. So I told you about the cyclotron motion. The electrons like to go around in a circle. In a magnetic field. Well, if there's a wall so that the electrons can't get out, then what they will do is they'll bounce off the wall and they'll just sort of skip along. And notice that the electrons here, they only want to go clockwise, which means that when they skip, they're only going to go up. They can't go down. Okay, so you sort of have these one-way states that the electrons can go in. Okay, and these are called edge states in the quantum Hall effect. And this is a familiar, to people who know about the quantum Hall effect, this is a familiar phenomena that occurs. Okay, now I want to think about these skipping edge states in a slightly different way. I want to think of, imagine I have these two different topological classes which are distinguished by this integer topological invariant. And I want to imagine trying to smoothly go from one to the other. Now, since they're distinguished, you know, an integer can't smoothly change from 1 to 0, okay? It has to happen abruptly. And so the only way that you can smoothly go from n equals 1 to n equals 0 is to somehow have the energy gap, which separates the valence band from the conduction band, go to 0. That's the only way it could happen, because if the energy gap doesn't close, the integer can't change. So what that means is that the energy gap has to close along the way, and so that means that there are going to be sort of low energy states bound to that interface. And so there's actually a very nice simple model you can write down for this. And again, I don't want to go through the mathematics of this, but it's basically if you imagine having a system where you have an energy gap, it goes to zero and it opens with the opposite sign, so the states sort of cross each other, then you could sort of say that that's like a band inversion. Here the energy gap has gone to zero. And it's a fact that there will be sort of bound states at this energy gap. And this is a very deep result in physics. I think it's one of the most beautiful and deep results that I know of. It was originally discovered by the field theorists, Jakeev and Rebbe in the 1970s, and then it was rediscovered by the condensed matter physicists in studying the theory of polyacetylene and the solitons that occur in polyacetylene. And so these bound states are guaranteed for deep topological reasons. Whenever you have an interface between different topological classes, you have to have these bound states. And so what this leads to is that these bound states give you electronic states which sort of connect the valence band to the conduction band. And so what I've drawn here is a plot of the energy of the electronic states as a function of the momentum going along the edge. So I still have translational symmetry going along the edge. And then, but perpendicular to the edge, I don't have it. So I sort of have a continuum of states in the valence band and the conduction band. But there has to be an edge state which connects the valence band to the conduction band, and it sort of is a one-way edge state because it has a positive group velocity. So these states correspond to these skipping orbits. Okay, they only go in one direction, and so this is a very special consequence that that having an interface between two different topological classes will have. Okay, so this is all sort of an introduction, because this physics was actually all understood, it's been understood since the 1980s, okay? What is new is that we have discovered a new topological classification. Now, in order to have the quantum Hall effect, you have to have a strong magnetic field, okay? We've discovered something that you can have without a strong magnetic field. And the way I sort of stumbled upon this, I really did stumble upon it, I wasn't looking for it. So what happened is back in 2005, or actually it's 2004, there were these beautiful experiments on graphene that came on. And so I knew about graphene before this, and so I was primed to think about it, and I thought, okay, here's my chance to do something big. I have to find something interesting on graphene. And so what I discovered, as you'll see, I did discover something, but it's going to end up not really being about graphene. So what I discovered was that if one allows for the interaction between the spin and the orbital degrees of freedom of the electron, okay, then in fact graphene does not have this Dirac structure where the valence band and the conduction band touch each other. In fact, there's an energy gap. Okay? Moreover, the way to think about that energy gap is the following. So electrons come in two varieties. There are the spin-up electrons and the spin-down electrons. Okay, so electrons are spin a half, so there are two different states they can be in. And in the simplest picture, this theory of graphene that I wrote down, it's really just two copies of there's a Hamiltonian for the upspin electrons and a Hamiltonian for the downspin electrons. And both of those Hamiltonians are just like Haldane's model, which had the quantum Hall effect. Okay? So it's like two copies of Haldane's model. But the quantum Hall effect for the upspins has the opposite sign of the quantum Hall effect for the downspins. So that means that when you apply an electric field, there's a Hall current going up for the upspins and going down for the downspins. So there's no net current that flows. It's an insulator, okay? But in a sense, there's a spin of a current of spin. There's a spin current that flows, okay? And for that reason, we call this the quantum spin Hall effect, okay? But the thing which is important here is that we know that the upspin electrons are in a quantum Hall state. That means they have to have these gapless edge states, okay? And so that means that there will be, at the edge of the of graphene, there will be conducting edge states where the upspins are going, say, to the right, and the downspins are going to the left. Okay, so this is a kind of an interesting property that sort of acts as a spin filter, if you will. If you add an electron, it'll either go this way or this way, depending on what its spin is. Okay, so this is something which is new, and so I can draw the band structure of say this edge state where there are going to be sort of upspin states which connect the conduction band and the valence band, and downspin states which connect the conduction band, the electron band. And so one thing that I realized, after I found this, is that this sort of so now these states can conduct electricity, okay? Because there are states at the Fermi energy; they're low energy states. And the thing that I realized is that this forms a really, really unique one-dimensional electronic conductor. Okay, it's unlike the other one-dimensional conductors that we know about. And it's unlike, because in a sense it's sort of half of an ordinary one. Because in an ordinary conductor, you can have both up and down spins can go to the right, and both up and down spins can go to the left. But this one is only half of that. Okay, and it's this one half is really leads to something new. Okay? And so I want to try to explain to you why this is a new electronic phase. And what I want to show you is that that it defines a new topological class for electronic states. for the states of an insulator. Okay, and so this is the picture where if you understand this picture, you will understand what a topological insulator is. So let me try to explain this. Okay, so what we discovered is that there's a new topological invariant which applies when one has time reversal symmetry, so if you don't have a magnetic field, okay? And so I could write down a mathematical formula for what this topological invariant is, but it's kind of complicated, and so I'm not going to do that. But what I can do is I can show you why, I can explain to you why it is that there are only two classes, okay? So it's a Z2, that means there's only two, there's zero or one, those are the only values it can have. It's either yes or no. It's either the trivial case, the trivial insulator, or the topological insulator. So here's how you can think about it. So and the thing that you need to understand in order to understand it is the consequence of time reversal symmetry when you have spin a half electrons. Okay? So electrons can be spin up and spin down. And when you have time reversal symmetry, the spin up states and the spin down states have to have the same energy. Okay, because the time reverse of the upspin is the downspin. And so this leads to a deep theorem called Cramer's theorem. Okay? Cramer's theorem says that when you have time reversal symmetry, all states of the system have to come in degenerate pairs. Okay? Now, so what I've plotted here is the electronic states associated with the edge of some arbitrary system that has a bulk energy gap. Okay, and so these states down here are the states in the valence band. The states up here are the states in the conduction band. And then there are these discrete energy bands that describe states which might or might not be bound to the surface. So these are sort of one-dimensional states bound to the surface. And I've plotted it as a function of the momentum, and I've only plotted sort of half of the states going from 0 to pi. I could have also plotted the states going from 0 to minus pi. You know, the states, the Brillouin zone goes from minus pi to pi, but I'm only plotting half because time reversal says that whatever is over here is mirrored on the other side. Okay, so here's the point. The point is that all the states have to come in pairs, which means that at k equals 0, this state has to be twofold degenerate. Okay, there have to be two states. Any state that is here has to be twofold degenerate. But of course, when I go away from k equals zero, if I have a spin orbit interaction, then those states will in general split because then this guy's partner is at minus k. Okay, so the states will split. Now, it's also a fact that at k equals pi, the states also have to be degenerate. The reason for that is because minus k is minus pi, but plus pi and minus pi are the same. Okay? So these states have to be twofold degenerate as well. So now you can see that there are two ways that this can fit together, two and only two ways that it can fit together. Either these states can sort of pair together pairwise like this, okay? In which case, you can imagine sort of pushing these states down into the valence band, these states up into the conduction band, and getting rid of them all together so that there are no edge states at all. This is what I'll call the conventional trivial insulator. The other possibility, though, is that they sort of switch partners, okay? And if they switch partners like this, then there's nothing you can do to get rid of these. Okay? They have to be degenerate at the endpoints. And if they're zigzagging up, you can push things up and down all you want, but there's always going to be these states present. Okay? And that's the reason why there are two classes of insulators. There are the insulators that do this, and there are the insulators that do this. Okay? That's what a topological insulator is. And the thing that is interesting about the topological insulators is that they have these topologically protected states on their edge. Okay? Okay. So I discovered this by thinking about graphene. Now, there's a problem with graphene. And the problem with graphene is that it's made out of carbon. Carbon is up near the top of the periodic table. And the elements at the top of the periodic table have a very weak spin orbit interaction. Okay? So the argument that I gave predicted that graphene had an energy gap, but it didn't predict how big the energy gap was. And it turns out it's puny. Okay? So graphene is not the best place to look for this topological insulating state. Okay? What you really want to do is you want to have material that has a strong spin orbit interaction. So you want to use elements that are down at the bottom of the periodic table. So to this end, Xucheng Zhang and his collaborators had a brilliant idea. And so they suggested making heterostructures out of mercury cadmium telluride. Okay? And so what they showed, in fact, is that if you make this sort of sandwich structure, which is called a quantum well, that in an appropriate range of thickness of this well, the two-dimensional state that occurs on this in this well is in fact in this topological insulating state, which means that on the edge it should have these conducting edge states. Okay, so they made this prediction in 2006, and it's really, this is an amazing thing. Within a year, the experiment, the devices had been made, and the experiment was done confirming this prediction. Okay, and so the experiments were done by Lawrence Mollenkopf and his group from Würzburg, and so they constructed these quantum well structures out of mercury cadmium telluride. Mercury cadmium telluride is a well-studied semiconductor system. So this is something that people knew how to work with this material. Okay, and so what they were able to do is they were able to actually measure the electrical conductance in these edge states. Okay, and they measured the electrical conductance, and since these things really are sort of perfect one-dimensional conductors, there's a prediction that the electrical conductance should be sort of quantized 2e squared over h. Okay, and that's that is what they saw. Okay, and so and moreover, what they were able to sort of change the width of the sample, and the conductance was independent of the width, which means that they were really measuring a property of the edge rather than the bulk, okay? And so so this was very strong evidence that these structures really were in this topological insulating quantum spin Hall insulator state, okay? And so this was really the discovery, the experimental discovery of the of a topological insulator. So once that we have this new topological phase in a two-dimensional system, the natural question is whether it could occur in a three-dimensional crystal. I mean, most materials that you have are three-dimensional. Okay, and so that led us to think about what would a three-dimensional topological insulator be. And one can analyze it sort of in the same way we analyze the two-dimensional topological insulator. A three-dimensional topological insulator will have a surface. And one can ask, what are the properties of the two-dimensional electronic states that might be on the surface? Okay, could there be topologically protected surface states? Okay, and so the way to think about the surface states, so the surface states are two-dimensional. I can classify them with in a two-dimensional Brillouin zone. Okay, and it turns out that in a two-dimensional Brillouin zone, there are sort of four of these points that are sort of like zero, where k and minus k are the same point. Okay, so that so I could have pi zero, pi pi, and zero pi. Those are the same as minus themselves. And so at all four of these points, the electronic states have to be degenerate. So then you could imagine going between any pair of these points and asking whether the picture looks like this or looks like this. Okay. And if it looks like this, then you can't get rid of them, just like in two dimensions. So it's a little bit more complicated because there are more possibilities. And it turns out that a three-dimensional crystal, rather than just being classified by one topological invariant, it turns out there are four. There are four Z2 topological invariants characterizing a three-dimensional crystal. Now, one thing that's interesting here is that if you look at these degeneracy points, the points that occur at, say, k equals 0 that have to be degenerate, if I go away in any direction, then the degeneracy gets lifted. You know, any direction in k. So really, the electronic dispersion has this sort of conical behavior. This is just like the Dirac point that occurred in graphene. Okay? So the surface states of this material, actually of any material, the surface states of any material with a spin-orbit interaction will have Dirac points at, you know, say k equals 0. Okay? Now, the interesting thing is how the Dirac points connect to each other, and in a strong topological insulator, where one of these is where nu zero invariant is equal to one, then the Dirac points connect to each other in such a way that the Fermi surface, you know, the where the states are filled up to, sort of encloses, just say one of these, okay, an odd number of these, okay. And so this then is a situation which looks just like graphing, okay, where you have this sort of Dirac-like dispersion, and you have a you have states that fill it. Okay, now it's like graphing, but it's different. Okay, it's different in the sense, you remember I made this big deal about graphing having two Dirac points, and that there's a deep reason you have to have two. Actually, there are four because you could have up and down spins in either of the two. Okay, whereas in this case there's just one. Okay, now one is against the rules. Okay, the only way you can get away with having one is having it be on a surface where you have one on the top surface and then its partner is on the bottom surface. Okay, that's the way. The topological insulator gets around that theorem that says you have to have an even number. Okay. And moreover, when you have just one, this is also it's really a unique electronic state, which is it's very robust. It turns out you can't screw it up. It won't rust. You can't make it localized by making it dirty. Okay. So this is really a unique kind of electronic state. Now, it turns out there are other states you can have, too, which we called weak topological insulators. They're interesting, but not as interesting as the strong topological insulator. You can sort of think of them as sort of layered versions of the two-dimensional state. But it's really the strong topological insulator which is interesting. And, you know, so we wrote this paper, you know, back in 2006, and in the last couple of years, this has completely blossomed, and there's a huge amount of activity. And really, it's been driven by experiments. And so our first idea. So the question is could this occur in a real material? Okay. And the first idea that we had was to think about an alloy between bismuth and antimony. And so what Liang Fu and I did is we analyzed the band structure of bismuth antimony, and from what was known about the band structure of these materials, we were able to conclude that this crystal should be a strong topological insulator. Okay, and shortly thereafter, Zahid Hassan from Princeton performed a angle-resolved photoemission experiment. And so, what angle-resolved photoemission is you send in light which kicks out electrons, and you measure the energy and momentum of the electrons that get kicked out. And by doing that, what you're able to do is you're able to map out the energy as a function of momentum for the occupied states in the crystal. And so with this picture, this is his data, and so this picture you can really read as the energy as a function of momentum for the occupied surface states. So now, of course, the data ends at zero because this is where the Fermi energy is. You don't get information about the unoccupied states, okay? But what he did is he realized that there are, going between gamma and m, which are sort of two of these time reversal points, invariant points, he saw that there were five bands that cross, okay? And the prediction is that there should be an odd number, okay? And so this was the first observation of a strong topological insulator, Okay, and so this sort of put this physics on the map. Okay, more recently, just in the last year, there's been another very important development, which is a new class of materials, which are also topological insulators, and these are bismuth selenide. And in a lot of ways, this material is even nicer. It turns out that the prediction is that there have to be an odd number of surface bands that cross. Well, the nicest odd number is one. Okay, five is more complicated than it has to be. Okay. In bismuth selenide, there's just one, and what that means is that the electronic dispersion of the surface states really does just look exactly like this single Dirac point. And Zahid Hassan has done the photo emission, and he's sort of mapped out exactly the dispersion of this band, and you see it cross beautifully. And moreover, they figured out how to tune the Fermi energy on the surface. There's a trick they can do, which is to dose it with NO2, and that adds electrons to the surface, and they're able to tune the Fermi energy through. And in fact, they've been able to tune the Fermi energy so it's exactly at this Dirac point on the surface. Okay, and so so this really I think is an amazing development. Okay, now that we have these materials. The question that presents itself is, what can we do with them? Okay, and so there are a number of interesting properties. So these surface states have interesting properties because they sort of correlate the electron spin with its momentum, and they're sort of spintronic type applications that one could think of doing with these. What I want to talk about for the last 10 minutes of my talk is sort of the most ambitious idea, which is to what happens when you combine these surface states with a superconductor. And what I'd like to argue to you is that leads us to something which could really be new. Okay. And so let me try to explain why putting a superconductor on it gives you something new. And in order to do that, I need to tell you a little bit about what a superconductor is. Okay? And so what I want to imagine is that I have a topological insulator. Maybe it's bismuth antimony, maybe it's bismuth selenide, or maybe some other topological insulator that hasn't been discovered yet. And I want to put some material which is a superconductor on top of it. And so what can happen then, in the theory of superconductivity, the electrons sort of form an energy gap, okay? And what can happen is that the superconductivity can leak into the surface states by what's called the proximity effect. So we basically are making the surface states of this topological insulator superconducting, okay? Now, in the BCS theory of a superconductor, the reason that it becomes superconducting is because there's an interaction between pairs of electrons which makes them want to pair up. And that leads to a condensation of the pairs of electrons. And in the usual superconductor, every electron has a partner. So an electron that's at K with spin up has a partner that it sort of mates with is at minus K and has spin down. Okay, and so these sort of bind together and condense into the superconducting state. So if we have these surface states which become superconducting, it's a little bit different, okay? Because in these surface states, these states are not spin degenerate. For every state, there isn't an upspin and a downspin. The upspin is on one side of the Fermi surface. The downspin is over here. And the spin sort of rotates around as you go around the Fermi surface. And so if you made these into a superconductor, then this and K and minus K still pair together. But it's like you only have half as much as you did up here. Okay? Because here I sort of had two sets of states which are condensing. Here there's only one. And so the superconducting state of the surface state is sort of like half of an ordinary superconductor. Okay, and this leads to something which is very non-trivial. So the thing which is non-trivial about that is what can happen if one has some sort of topological defect. And so what I want to imagine is in the superconductor having what's called a vortex. And a vortex is sort of a line, you know, it's sort of a point-like topological defect where the superconducting phase winds by 2 pi. Okay? And in this point defect, there can be bound states. And these bound states in an ordinary superconductor, they sort of tend to come in pairs like this. And moreover, in the theory of superconductivity, there's an important thing, which is that you can have bound states, but every state at positive energy has a partner at negative energy. Okay, and this is sort of built into the BCS theory of superconductivity. And in fact, the state at positive energy is redundant. It means the state at positive energy means the same thing as the state at negative energy, which means that adding a quasiparticle into a positive energy state is the same operation as taking a quasiparticle out of the negative energy state. Okay, so there's this redundancy that occurs. And so the thing that can happen in this new superconducting state that we have is that one can have a bound state that is exactly at energy zero. Okay, so this is allowed. But what that means is that it's really sort of only half of a state because this is redundant. You know, you really, 2 states make up a state. It's really sort of a state where adding an electron and taking an electron away is really the same operation. So for these states, the electron is its own antiparticle. Okay? Now this is something which has come up in other branches of physics, and these are called Majorana fermions. Okay? So this is the thing which is really new that could happen. So let me just digress for a minute and talk about Majorana fermions, because this is something which is very exciting. So again, what a Majorana fermion is it's a particle that is its own antiparticle. So adding it and taking it away does the same thing. Okay? There are various possible ways where this may come up in physics. Okay, and in fact, this is something which people have known about in particle physics for a long time, and there's this idea that a neutrino might be a Majorana fermion. Okay, and we don't know. But people are trying to find out. And in fact, if it is a Majorana fermion, then a neutron is its own antiparticle. And what that allows is that allows certain beta decay processes where where you emit 2 neutrons, and then those 2 neutrons annihilate each other. Okay, so it allows a neutrinoless double beta decay. And so this is actually something which is being actively looked for at the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. I have a colleague at Penn, Gene Beyer, who actually we just learned was awarded the Panofsky Prize for elementary particle physics this year. And so he's very actively involved in SNO. And one of the things they're trying to do is trying to see whether or not a neutrino is a Majorana fermion. So I have a friendly wager with Gene about whether or not the Majorana fermion will be discovered first in particle physics or in condensed matter physics. Okay, and I'm voting for condensed matter. So in condensed matter, there are a number of places where this may occur. One promising case is in the fractional quantum Hall effect at filling nu equals 5/2. There's some chiral superconductors where this might occur in vortices in this chiral superconductor. And I want to add these topological insulator superconductor structures to this list. Okay. This has not been observed yet in any physics, okay? And so I think one of the things that may come out of this would be the observation of a Majorana fermion, which I think would be an exciting first thing to happen. Okay, so why would this be important, though? Okay, and this is a very deep idea that was put forth by Alexei Kitaev, who's at Caltech. And so Kitaev had the brilliant insight that if you had Majorana fermions, maybe you could use them to make a quantum computer. Okay, and here's the idea. Okay, I told you that a Majorana fermion by itself is sort of half of a state. That means 2 of them is one state that an electron can that can either be occupied or empty. So two Majorana fermions makes a two-level system. There are two states it can have, full or empty. Okay? If you have two n of these, then you have a sort of 2^n states. So each pair of Majorana fermions is like a qubit. It's a two-level system. That's the elementary sort of memory element of a quantum computer. Okay? But it can be a superposition of those two states. So 2n separated Majoranas is like n qubits. And the beauty of it is, the whole problem with quantum computers is that you want to keep the system from accidentally measuring itself. Because if the state gets measured, then it collapses. Okay? The beauty here is that the quantum information that tells you about the state is stored non-locally between these two well-separated Majorana fermions, which means that by doing a local measurement, you can't measure the state. The only way you can measure it is by doing some non-local measurement. And so if you have sort of local sources of decoherence, these Majorana fermions are immune to that local source of decoherence. And for that reason, these Majorana fermions could make a robust quantum memory that allows one to sort of store quantum information without having it be accidentally measured. Moreover, if you can get a handle on these Majorana fermions and move them around and braid them, then performs unitary operations on the state of these n qubits. That's what a quantum computer is supposed to do. So the operation of a quantum computer is to perform a unitary operation on the state of some set of n qubits. And then you get the answer. Okay? So in principle, if one can do that, then one can make a topological quantum computer. Okay? And so So in order to implement this, then you have to have some way of making your Majorana fermions and moving them around and then measuring them. Okay, and so we have some ideas for that. I think rather than go through this in detail, I think maybe I'll just say that we have protocols where you can imagine creating the Majorana fermions, braiding them around, and then measuring them. Okay, and in principle, this could allow one to make some sort of non-trivial quantum computing device. Okay. Now, of course, there are lots of hurdles that have to be overcome before this can be accomplished. Okay. So we're still at the on the ground floor with this. Okay. But there's potential that maybe this could happen. And so so I think maybe with that I will finish up. And so the main conclusion of this talk is that there's this new electronic phase of matter, which has been predicted and observed, both in two-dimensional systems in the quantum spin Hall insulator and in three-dimensional topological insulators. And this, if you can sort of marry these topological insulators with a superconductor, then this is a structure which can host Majorana fermions, which maybe one could make a quantum computer out of. Okay, so look, there's a lot of challenges. We're still in the early days of this. This field has sort of ballooned in the last year, and so I'm very hopeful that there's going to be a lot of progress that's made in the coming years. So thank you very much.